Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm your host, Dean Johnson, sitting in tonight for Jeff Hayden, who's busy fighting for justice in our courts. 2 weeks ago, we did a show on the landmark Dobbs decision, which overturned Roe versus Wade and in one stroke stripped women of their federal constitutional right to choose. We asked, where is this going? Are our other rights in danger? Here are some of the headlines that have appeared in the days since that show. Quote, a new Supreme Court case is the biggest threat to our democracy since January 6th. Alabama, citing the Supreme Court anti-abortion decision, challenges the right to treat transgender children. Interstate abortion travel ban? This is supposed to be a free country. And perhaps most dire, the U.S. Supreme Court is turning the Constitution into a suicide pact. There are signs of pushback. Governor Newsom has asked for a $125 million package, part of which is to guarantee abortion rights to women coming from out of state. Tech companies have promised to auto-delete internet information of women that could be used to prosecute them when they come from trigger law states. Bay Area counties have allocated millions of dollars to reproductive health care. There is a pending bill to bar enforced law enforcement from aiding trigger law prosecutions. District attorneys have announced that they will not cooperate with trigger law states. California is seeking, through a ballot initiative, to write reproductive rights into the state constitution. And in Florida, a Jewish rabbi has turned SCOTUS's own pronouncements against them, arguing that the ban on abortion violates his religious liberties. And it's reported, ironically, that the SCOTUS judges who voted to overturn Roe versus Wade have had their private information leaked to the public. But that shouldn't be a problem because, after all, they'd be the first to tell you that there's no right of privacy. Tonight we discuss whether any of your rights are safe, whether democracy itself may be in peril, and more importantly, what can we do about it? And we want to hear your take on this. Give us a call at 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134 if you're in the San Francisco Bay Area. Or if you're outside of the local dialing area, you can call us at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. And please bear in mind that our guests are here to educate and inform about legal issues of the day. They cannot provide legal advice on particular cases. The opinions expressed on this show are not necessarily the opinions of KALW, NPR, the San Mateo County Bar Association, or any of our guests' employers. Tonight, we have an outstanding panel of guests to help us make sense of this constitutional chaos. Ben Foyer is the chairman of the California Appellate Law Group, a boutique law firm specializing in appeals with offices in San Francisco, Los Angeles, and San Diego. Ben has been called one of the top appellate litigators in California by a national news network and named one of the top 40 lawyers in California under 40 by the Daily Journal, among other honors. He clerked on the Ninth Circuit, and he frequently writes on constitutional and appellate matters for publications like the Washington Post, the LA Times, and the National Law Journal. Ann Voigt is a partner at King & Spalding. She has worked on cases before the United States Supreme Court and the California Supreme Court. She previously served as a clerk for the Ninth Circuit and the United States Supreme Court as a federal prosecutor. Professor Lawrence Douglas is the James J. Grossfield Professor of Law, Jurisprudence, and Social Thought at Amherst College. Professor Douglas is the author of Will He Go? Trump and the Looming Electoral Meltdown in 2020, in which he predicted, almost to the hour, the events of January 6th. He is most recently the author of an article in The Guardian entitled The U.S. Supreme Court is Turning the Constitution into a Suicide Pact. Let me welcome all our guests.
We're glad to be here, Dean.
Great to be with you again.
All right. Terrific. As you guys know,
that's a good article title, Lawrence. I think that you've I haven't read the piece, but from the title, I think I already think you're onto something.
Well, you know, I wanted to ask Lawrence about that phrase, the Constitution as a suicide pact. That has a history, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of paraphrasing Justice Jackson, Robert H. Jackson, who is kind of a great mid-century associate justice on the U.S. Supreme Court. And to kind of roughly paraphrase Jackson, he once said, well, however the court reads the Supreme, however the court reads the Constitution, it should not read it as a suicide pact. And I think what he meant by that is that the court should not read the Constitution as basically destructive of the very ends that it was designed to serve. And if you think about some of the greatest problems that are facing our nation today, problems such as gun violence, climate change, the hyperpartisanship between red and blue states over issues like abortion, the integrity of our electoral system, these four issues, it strikes me that the court is intervening, is offering interpretations of the Constitution that is turning the Constitution into an obstacle, a force of division, rather than a force of a solution. And it strikes me that's an incredibly dangerous way to go about reading the Constitution.
You know, and I think to kind of pick up on that idea, because I think it's absolutely an excellent one, the conservative legal movement for quite a long time has kind of taken the position that it opposed so-called activist judging, judges that use the Constitution or the statutes to prevent the states, especially, from doing things that the states think are best. And especially on the issue of guns, where you really do have people in their communities terrified of sending their kids to school. The Supreme Court has, certainly at least this term, and even, you know, starting in the last decade, issued some rulings that have made it very difficult for states to protect their own citizens in the way those citizens think best. I think really jumps out as kind of an example of what Lawrence is identifying, a really strong example of what Lawrence is identifying, this idea that, hey, in our community, we want to, you know, you all in deep Texas or Alabama, you guys want to shoot each other up every day, you know, go for it. But we in our community, we want to pass laws that kind of protect folks from that. And the Supreme Court sort of stepping in and saying, oh, no, you can't.
Yeah. And if I can just follow up on Ben's point, I mean, I think it's absolutely right. I think there's something very misleading about characterizing the present Supreme Court as conservative. It really is a kind of a radical court, not a conservative court. I mean, if you even think about the gun law that was overturned by the court in the Bruen case, I mean, this was a law that had been on the books for over a century. In fact, if we kind of just look at the Supreme Court's Second Amendment jurisprudence from 1791 until 2008, the total number of state regulations that had been struck down as unconstitutional violation of the Second Amendment, the total number of such laws struck down by the Supreme Court was exactly zero. The court had never done it. And so there's nothing conservative about this court. This court is really kind of radically reshaping our fundamental document. And as Ben pointed out, in ways that really kind of stand in the way of solving pressing social problems.
Right? I mean, the idea that the framers would have thought that states and communities could not restrict the ability of folks to possess weapons that can kill hundreds of people all at once is frankly ludicrous. It is a botching of originalism and any kind of honest reading of the Constitution, even from a conservative originalist perspective. It is pure policy, Republican conservative policy, that these judges, beginning with Justice Scalia, who was one of the innovators of the idea of originalism, but in my view, really totally engaged in pure sophistry in his decision in the case in 2008 that found an individual constitutional right to bear arms for the first time, where he read out of the Constitution the words well-regulated militia. It's the only time he's ever said words in a constitution or statute don't mean anything. And that has kind of enabled this, I would even say, reactionary conservative core, even more than radical, to push forward certain policies that are creating a constitutional suicide pact, or perhaps a murder suicide pact, one might say.
Yeah. And actually, just to follow up just very briefly on that point, is it's even worth bearing in mind that, for example, Warren Burger, who, as we recall, was a conservative chief justice who was appointed by Richard Nixon, he said the idea that the Second Amendment creates a personal right to gun ownership is, and this is a quote from Warren Burger, he said it was one of the greatest pieces of fraud, and I repeat the word fraud, on the American public by special interest groups that I've ever seen in my lifetime. And what we've now seen is we've seen the Supreme Court basically elevate this fraud into a constitutional doctrine.
And the NRA, an organization that has in fact been accused, I believe, by the state of New York of fraud, engaging in this kind of constitutional fraud in order to further a policy that some conservative folks like. They like guns, and that's fine. Look, you know, you want to live in a community with guns and you like guns, that's fine. That's what democracy is about. Have guns in your community. But to say the Constitution prevents other communities from limiting guns, you know, is totally ludicrous. And I think Lawrence really kind of hits on an excellent point with what he just said by identifying a different view from Justice Burger and other justices, because this Supreme Court, as currently composed, which is absolutely the most conservative Supreme Court or even reactionary Supreme Court this country has seen in 100 years, this Supreme Court has no problem totally rejecting the wisdom and judgment of justices that came before it. And I think you can really see that in the abortion context, where essentially five justices of the Supreme Court today said, boy, we think Roe versus Wade was just totally, absolutely, egregiously wrong from the outset, ignoring the fact that 18 Supreme Court justices in the 50 years since Roe versus Wade was written and then the basic principles reaffirmed in the Casey opinion, 18 Supreme Court justices, a majority of whom were Republican appointees, found this constitutional right to abortion in one form or another to be a correct interpretation of the Constitution.
So let me, Ben, if
it's wrong now, to say it's egregiously wrong, it's totally wrong, completely wrong from the outset, is to totally discount the intellect of 18 other excellent judges and justices of the Supreme Court who came before.
So, Ben, let me ask you a question. If we can boil this down, it sounds like up until about 3 weeks ago, the Supreme Court was doing kind of a cost-benefit analysis. It tried to weigh the interest of state regulation against fundamental rights. But now that's gone out the door. This is historicism on steroids, where they say, hey, if it didn't exist back in the Founding Fathers' day, it doesn't exist now. And state regulations,
guns,
state
where it didn't exist in the founding, except with guns, where it didn't exist in the founding fathers' days or 200 years after, but does exist now, right?
Yeah.
So it's kind of pick and choose. But you're right. I mean, on the, you know, in the Dobbs opinion, you know, the court kind of this wasn't the first time the Supreme Court has said this, that the idea of fundamental liberties are based on very historical, traditional liberties that the country has long recognized. And this idea really came out of an opinion from, I want to say, the early 2000s or maybe the late 1990s, involving a case in which a party sought to identify a constitutional right to assisted suicide. I think it was like 97, I want to say, a case called Washington against Glucksberg. Someone brought a lawsuit in Washington state saying that, hey, you know, this idea of liberty that protects abortion rights and the ability to buy contraceptives for at least for married couples, and which is later found to protect rights to same-sex relationships. That also protects sort of this fundamental individual right to assisted suicide. And it sort of arose out of this idea that, look, you have in the United States this basic constitutional idea of autonomy, of individual autonomy, at least when you're dealing with yourself and your major personal life decisions. And the Supreme Court said no. The Supreme Court there said, look, this idea doesn't extend to something like assisted suicide. There's never been a sort of a tradition in the United States that you have a constitutional right to assisted suicide, and we're not going to read that into the Constitution. And so the Supreme Court here in Dobbs sort of went with that language and that idea and said sort of the same thing as we said in the assisted suicide case, you know, only those very basic fundamental ideas of liberty that are embedded in the Constitution and we've recognized for centuries, maybe, that those are what we're going to consider to be protected liberty. It is intellectually incoherent. There is no coherent intellectual basis for this analysis. It's just the Supreme Court making stuff up.
Well, we talked about this almost jokingly a couple of weeks ago, and we said that this kind of analysis leads to some bizarre consequences. But, Lawrence, let me ask you about a case that's in front of the Alabama Supreme Court right now. This is a case in which there's a challenge to a ban by the state of Alabama on the right of parents to provide certain treatments to transgender children. And the attorney general, in his briefs to the Alabama Supreme Court, said, and I quote, "The district court thus erred when it found in the due process clause a fundamental right for parents to treat their children with transitioning medication. Neither the district court nor plaintiffs even attempted to show how such a right is deeply rooted in our nation's history and traditions, which it obviously is not." So, Lawrence, you are a constitutional scholar. Let me ask you this. How could our founding fathers, in their infinite wisdom, have overlooked the right to puberty blockers and to other treatments for transgender children when they were drafting the Constitution?
Right. Well, I mean, one thing is, I mean, just to be absolutely clear about it, just technically the way the argument is structured, I think the argument goes more like this. Is there anything within the text of the Constitution itself that provides a fundamental right to engage in transitioning medication? Now, obviously, if you ask the question that way, the answer has to be no. There's nothing in the text of the Constitution that provides that. Then the next question that the court will ask is, well, if it's not explicitly in the Constitution, is it then deeply embedded in our nation's history and traditions? And there they come along and they say, no, it's not deeply embedded in our nation's history and traditions, and therefore there is no such right. That's kind of, I think, the structure of the argument. But I think this goes back to the point that Ben was making, is that there's something incredibly almost bordering on bad faith about the kind of argument that relies on asking whether something is deeply embedded in the nation's history and traditions. Because if you ask something along the lines of, and this goes back to a case that disastrous decision by the case, by the court decided in 1986, this Bowers v. Hardwick case, which involved a question about the constitutionality of a Georgia state statute, which criminalized people from engaging in consensual gay sex. And at that point, the court said, is there any problem with that? No, there's no problem with criminalizing consensual gay sex. Why? Well, because consensual gay sex has not been deeply embedded in the nation's history and traditions. And so there's all sorts of ways in which you can kind of cherry pick history for the purposes of deciding what's in and out. And it really ultimately turns on, you know, politics. And this idea that that by kind of scanning our history and traditions, we're going to be able to get a deep insight into questions as to whether, what about interracial marriages? Were they deeply embedded in our nation's history and traditions? Most emphatically not. Does that then mean that states can ban interracial marriages? Well, that's a completely ludicrous proposition. And today the court, you know, more recently has rightly overturned the Bowers v. Hardwick decision of 1986, recognizing that, of course, the right to privacy is deeply embedded in the nation's history and traditions, and it extends to things such as engaging in consensual sexual contact. And so the question is not whether there's a fundamental right to engage to supply transitioning medication. The question is there a fundamental right to guide the destiny of your child that has been deeply embedded in our nation's history and traditions? And there, I think you can say the answer is yes.
Yeah, I'm not. I mean, I'm not totally sure I agree in the following way. The courts have stepped in and very clearly said that state laws banning, I don't know what they call it, conversion therapy, or whatever it's called when you have a gay child. Some parents send their kids to these quacks, basically therapists who give them electroshock treatment and God knows what they do to try to make them straight. And the courts have said, look, states want to ban that. The states can ban that. And so, you know, the idea that parents have this kind of ultimate fundamental right to guide their children in terms of how their sexuality develops is clearly not accurate. I mean, there's clearly a problem with that because the courts have said, look, you can't do it the other way. So I'm not totally sure I agree with the idea that even under the kind of substantive due process analysis that existed before Dobbs, that sort of gender affirming care, as it's called, would fall into that, you know, that particular liberty. I think that really the problem that we're wrestling with here is that the Constitution has a big flaw, that the courts have innovated this doctrine that they call substantive due process to kind of put a Band-Aid on this flaw, to paper it over. But the reality is the Constitution should protect individual autonomy in major life decisions like who you marry and who you choose to have sexual relationships with, and perhaps to a certain degree how you raise your children, whether you send them to private or public school. But it doesn't. Nothing in the Constitution really recognizes this kind of right of autonomy. And this is why the Griswold against Connecticut case, which was sort of the first major sexual liberty case that said that individuals have a married couples have a right to purchase contraception, why it had to rely on an idea that was called a penumbra. That it said, look, if you look across all of the constitutional amendments, there's really this broad protection of personal privacy. And over the years since then, that was in the 1960s, and over the years since then, the court has really struggled to find a better intellectual basis for this right that I think many of us recognize the Constitution really ought to protect, but on its face just doesn't. And that's a problem. Justice Scalia said the biggest problem with the Constitution of the United States is that it is too difficult to amend. And I think that one of the reasons we are having this struggle is because the Constitution is too difficult to amend. And so we can't fix this problem in any kind of easy or manageable way. I know that Lawrence perhaps wanted to say something. He was holding up his finger.
Let me just jump in real quick before you respond, Lawrence, and remind our listeners that you're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW, 91.7 FM in the San Francisco Bay Area. And tonight we're talking about constitutional crisis with appellate attorneys Ben Foyer and Ann Voigt and constitutional law professor Lawrence Douglas. If you have any questions for our guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Or if you're outside of the Bay Area, you can call us on our dime at 866-798-8255. And as always, you may call with any question that's pertinent to our current topic. You're not limited to what we're talking about at the particular moment. Going back to you, Lawrence, I just have this picture that I can't get out of my head of Ben Franklin, who was, you know, a very forward-thinking guy ahead of his time, talking at the Constitutional Convention and saying, you know, we really should put something about LGBT rights in this Constitution. And probably Thomas Jefferson leaned over and said, don't worry, if it ever comes up, the court will do the right thing. And besides, Hamilton's coming along with some great amendments that'll take care of that.
There's no way the framers had any conversation similar to that. The idea that the federal constitution would protect individual rights like that in 1776 was so far outside of what the framers were thinking.
I was being sarcastic. Let's get Lawrence's response. You invited that. Let's give him an opportunity to talk.
Yeah, actually, can I just very briefly, I just want to make, just clarify something just so I didn't leave a mistaken impression. I wasn't arguing that that parents' rights to control their children or their parental rights clearly support the result that they can offer transitioning medication. What I was trying to make the argument is that anyone who relies on the notion of whether a practice is deeply embedded in the history, in the nation's history and traditions, needs to kind of realize that you can engage in this very strategic cherry picking, that depending on how you characterize what it is that's deeply embedded, if you characterize it as transitioning medication, obviously, the answer is going to be no. If you characterize it as parental rights, the answer looks a whole lot more like yes. And that's the only thing I was trying to point out, that there's this incredible level of cherry picking that goes on by the court in order to basically reach what I would think is ultimately a political conclusion. I do agree with Ben that that it would be nice if we had a more explicit right to privacy, right to bodily integrity and autonomy that was anchored in the Constitution. That said, you know, I also want to emphasize that the jurisprudence of recognizing a right to privacy is pretty damn settled in this country. I mean, there is a right to privacy. It might not be explicitly written in the Constitution, but it has been recognized by the courts for well over half a century. And even if it were explicitly written into the Constitution, it would still raise these deep interpretive issues as to what's its scope. So I'm not sure if actually having a little piece of text, you know, maybe, you know, an alternative universe that can be whole numbers between 5 and 6 or something like that. But, you know, if we look closely, we find, oh, there was this right to privacy that was interpolated into the Constitution. It still would invite deep interpretive questions about its scope. And I think those kinds of interpretive matters have been deeply politicized and radicalized by the present Supreme Court.
Well, let's take a break now to have our station identify itself, and then I'd like to come back to Ann Voigt.
This is 91.7 KALW and online KALW.org. Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
And we're back with Your Legal Rights on KALW. And Voight, I'd like to come to you. You know, we've been talking about how the Supreme Court has been invoking the Founding Fathers time and time again now, but they've also been really inventive. I'm thinking about cases like the case of West Virginia versus EPA, which appears to have essentially gutted administrative law in one fell swoop, and they were the court was very inventive in doing so, correct?
So, you know, just for your listeners to put this in some context, you know, when we talk about administrative law, what that means is, like, what can an agency do? For, in this case, can they institute regulations designed to address climate change? But in other contexts, you know, can they impose regulations designed to ensure workplace safety? Agencies play an enormous role in our lives in determining the way that we work, the way that we travel, all sorts of things. And part of the way that that is functioned is by Congress being able to delegate matters to agencies based on the expectation that they have a certain expertise, that they can resolve this, that they know more than your average Joe or certainly your average congressperson. But, you know, what we see with this case is a real pushback, and it's, you know, part of a larger process of pushing back on the administrative state and on agency power to make precisely those sorts of decisions. And we will see what happens. I think there was some thinking that originally the focus was going to be on whether courts have to defer to an agency's regulations. But there are also questions about what Congress can delegate in the first place to an agency to decide. So leaving aside whether you even have to defer to those regulations, can they issue those regulations in the first place? And Ben, I'm sort of interested in your take, where you think this is going.
I think that the court, the conservatives on the court would like to totally gut the administrative state and the ability of administrative agencies to kind of have discretion in any kind of broad way over their decision making. You know, for the most part, conservatives tend to be against regulation. Administrative agencies regulate, and it's that simple. I think that's where this is going. Of course, that assumes the country doesn't completely burn down before they have a chance to do that, because the EPA is now going to be significantly limited in its ability to regulate greenhouse gases. Of course, the court's response to something like this is, hey, look, if Congress wants to give authority to the agency to regulate greenhouse gases, Congress can do that. This wasn't a constitutional law decision. This was a decision of statutory interpretation. So it is, at least theoretically, if our Congress was working correctly, much easier for the legislative branches to intervene and change the way that policy works than it is in a case involving gun rights or abortion, where the Supreme Court is making its decision based on the Constitution itself.
Well, Lawrence, let me ask you, as I read this EPA case, the court is articulating a doctrine called the major issues doctrine. Where did that come from? I mean, I don't remember the founding fathers talking about that.
Well, this major questions doctrine, I think, is something that the court basically invented out of whole cloth. And I think it's basically is the idea that when it comes to these kind of major questions of economic and political significance, Congress has to, speak with particular clarity, the court said. And in this sense, in this case, they said the court hadn't spoken with
Congress.
Congress had not spoken with sufficient clarity. It is also, you know, worth pointing out that it's not as if Congress is powerless in dealing with agencies that they believe have exceeded their regulatory power. I mean, it doesn't need the court's solicitude for the purposes of reining in these administrative agencies. If Congress were unhappy with the way the EPA is dealing with climate change, well, Congress has the authority to kind of step in and even change the law. And so it's kind of remarkable that the court would arrogate unto itself this power to determine when the delegation has exceeded what Congress intended. And again, not to mention the fact that, you know, as Ben pointed out, and Anne pointed out as well, I mean, we're dealing with, you know, a problem of existential dimensions of climate change. And the idea that the court is intervening to basically disable the executive branch from addressing this existential problem. And again, not, I think it's worth mentioning it. You have someone on the court like Amy Coney Barrett, who in her confirmation hearing, even though she was willing to concede remarkably that cigarettes cause cancer and that COVID is an infectious disease, she was not willing to concede that the reality of human-caused climate change. She said that was a kind of a fraught political question that she wasn't going to get involved in.
Well, let's go to our listeners. Dorothea from Berkeley, you're on the line.
Hi, thanks. My question is this. In light of the last four decisions, and in light of what you guys have said, that this is a radical court, do you think, you know, with the strengthening of people's ability to have more and more guns, do you think that this court is destroying the federal government and their intention actually is to have some sort of civil war? I know that sounds extreme, but everything that's going on lately is very extreme, in my opinion, when you take away the rights of half the population to control their own bodies. That's pretty extreme. And then what you just said about the EPA, that eviscerates the Congress's ability to regulate. So do you think that's what's going on here? There's an agenda that's much bigger than just any one of these things.
Great question, Dorothea. And, you know, we've talked about the Blue State Rebellion a couple of times on this show. And Lawrence, you are the prophet among us. You predicted January 6th. Are we at the point where we're going to see state governments and even individuals openly defying federal authority?
Well, I mean, maybe I'd answer the question two ways. One was the question about the intention of the court itself. And there I would not say that the intention of the court is in any way to trigger a civil war. I don't think that's the case at all. And again, I can't, you know, I'm not a psychologist. It's beyond my pay grade. I don't know exactly what goes on in the personal conversations between Clarence Thomas and his wife, who does seem to have, you know, extremely radical political beliefs.
Ought to be a fly on the wall.
Yes, exactly. I would love to be that. But that said, I mean, is it the case that, you know, the Supreme Court is catapulting us into a very dangerous period in our history? And I think the answer, unfortunately, is yes. I mean, I would hate to see open defiance of federal law or constitutional decisions. I mean, there's a famous semi-apocryphal statement that's attributed to President Jackson in the early part of the 19th century, where after the Supreme Court, with John Marshall as the Chief Justice, made a decision that Jackson didn't like, he said, well, John Marshall has made his decision, now let him enforce it. And you know, obviously the court's decisions rely on the coordinated branches of government for the enforcement. And I would hate to see the country in such a kind of world of hurt in which we have open defiance of Supreme Court decisions. It is interesting to see that there was in the New York Times today, there was a report about a poll that the Times had conducted, just showing a remarkable degree of disaffection with American democracy in the country today. And that the disaffection was, in a sense, even greater among Democrats than among Republicans. I thought that was really kind of remarkable outcome of that survey.
Well, you know, I'm certainly not a conspiracy theorist, but if you look at this big picture, I mean, it's almost, if there were an intention to undermine American democracy, this is certainly, you probably couldn't plan it any better. I mean, you have the Supreme Court articulating these doctrines that put everything back in the hands of state legislatures. And then we have the trailer, the coming soon, of a case called Harper versus Moore, which has been called potentially the greatest threat to American democracy since January 6th. Can you tell us a little bit about that? And anybody, Ben or Lawrence, jump in.
Well, that, you know, I'm sure. So the Harper versus Moore is a case. So the Constitution, for the most part, gives the rights to states to determine anything the Constitution doesn't specifically talk about. When talking about elections and how elections will work, the Constitution specifically refers to state legislatures. So there's a theory out there, and it has long been thought to be a totally ludicrous theory, although clearly four justices on the Supreme Court maybe think not, because it takes four justices to take a case, grant cert. But there's a theory that that phrase means only the legislatures can decide how elections proceed, and state courts cannot step in to say, hey, look, whatever the legislature is trying to do is in violation of our state constitution or the federal constitution. And so essentially whatever the legislature wants goes, even if it is in direct violation of some other state law or constitutional provision or federal law or federal provision. That's the theory. You know, we'll see what happens. I don't think the counter argument is that state courts operate, you know, within the constraints of the state legislature and essentially act, you know, are created by you know, the state legislature and regulated by the state legislature. I would be surprised if a majority on the court take this invitation to essentially give writ large control over elections to state legislatures in terms of how they operate, given how intensely corrupt and gerrymandered many of our state legislatures are. I mean, this country's really, look, 50 banana republics stitched together. maybe not 50, maybe 40 with 10 good democracies in there. But the but it might be a 5-4 decision. I mean, it's certainly an idea that has captured the interest of some members of the court, who at least claim to be textualists, you know, so we'll see what happens. Ultimately, the framers of the Constitution sort of did think a little bit about the risks that elections, at least for president, would have problems. They were thinking about situations where the guy on horseback carrying the ballots results to Congress in Washington, D.C., which might take weeks, gets waylaid and his horse breaks his leg and he dies and the election results never get there. They weren't really thinking of the voting machines not working properly, or as has been alleged falsely. But they did ultimately say, look, the state legislatures get to decide how electoral counts, you know, electoral votes will be allocated in the end. And this is something, obviously, the election, the phonies that were working and are still working for Trump have been pushing, this idea that, hey, state legislatures, you can just get rid of the vote of the people and issue your own decision about who will get the electoral votes of your state. State laws don't allow that. But the framers did recognize this possibility. And so there is this idea that maybe state legislatures will eventually, be in a position of deciding what the electoral votes would be if they change the state law to match.
So, Lawrence, I wonder what's the Supreme Court doing in a case like, it sounds like it's a case of state law and state courts determining or interpreting state law under judicial review, and the Supreme Court is intervening and applying a federal standard. I mean, does the Supreme Court really have any business saying whether state courts can engage in judicial review of their own legislatures? I mean, that seems like the job of state courts.
Right. But I think the point is, and this is, I think the point that Ben was making is, if you look at the Constitution seems to suggest that when it comes to elections, the state legislatures have, you know, pretty much control over how the elections are run in the state. And that bit of constitutional language has then been grabbed, and in my mind, and I think in Ben's mind as well, has been misappropriated and enlisted into really what was, you know, not a mainstream theory at all, this whole notion of an independent state legislature theory, basically saying, well, the state legislature's power is, it's not just there, it's plenary, and nothing can trump it. That is, no state court decision, even a state court defending a state constitutional provision cannot trump what the state legislature is doing when it comes to the election. And again, that might sound, you know, pretty technical to your listeners, but I think we all are well aware of the way in which Trump was successful in operationalizing the big lie. And we know that there were members of state legislatures all over the country who bought into the big lie. And we also know that, you know, recall that in this past election, when Biden won with a very decisive 7 million popular vote victory, if he had lost 44,000 votes in Arizona, Georgia, and Wisconsin combined, we would have had an electoral college tie. And if you imagine state legislators in these three states, again, this is just speculating about, let's say, 2024, if you have them muddying the waters, and if you have them basically saying, no, we can't trust what looks like the popular vote outcome, and we're now going to appoint a different slate of electors, and then basically have the Supreme Court saying, well, that is not reviewable by any state court. I mean, that is potentially an incredibly destabilizing and dangerous world. And I think that's the real concern about this Moore v. Harper, though. Again, you know, if I were just to predict, I would predict the outcome in precisely the same way that that Ben did. I would say that probably this independent state legislature theory is not going to get a majority on the court, though it's still frightening enough to imagine that it's only one vote short of gaining a majority.
Well, that, you know, that gets me back to my question. I mean, as I said, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but it almost seems like we are being set up or could be set up for the next election or for 2024. I mean, with legislatures having an untrammeled authority to structure their voting any way they want, I mean, that opens the door for unlimited gerrymandering, as you said, without any possibility of judicial review. One person, one vote could essentially go out the door and nobody could do anything about it, right?
You know, the Constitution itself doesn't say one person, one vote. That was a Supreme Court decision from, I think, the 1950s or 1960s that came up with the idea of one person, one vote being kind of a constitutional principle. The Constitution is written really, and this goes back to a point that we're making that I sort of didn't have a chance to make a little bit earlier in the show when you were talking about what kind of Thomas Jefferson and Ben Franklin would be talking, you know, to one another kind of on the side of the Constitutional Convention in 1776. When the Constitution was written, the framers believed that the states would be in a role of protecting individuals from an oppressive federal government. That is, your state would be the body that would basically protect your rights. And every limitation that they came up with was a limitation on the federal government. When the Civil War happened, that changed with the 14th Amendment. Then all of a sudden, the federal government was put in a position of protecting individuals and individual rights from their oppressive state legislatures and state governments. And that has kind of been the overriding principle since the late 1800s. Now, with this shift in the Supreme Court, again, this is the biggest shift in 100 years, perhaps more. Now I think we are in a position where the federal government may not be in a position of having the power, as the Supreme Court is interpreting it, of protecting individuals and individual rights from from oppressive states in the same way that the federal government did for most of the 20th century.
Well, Lawrence, isn't this exactly the kind of problem that the post-Civil War amendments were intended to solve? I mean, the way I look at it, the founding fathers had a great blueprint for a free society, but they had some problems. Obviously, they were slaveholders. They had a certain perspective on who counted and who didn't count in society. So there were flaws in the blueprint. And those flaws led to the Civil War and then to the post-Civil War amendments. It seems to me that 14th Amendment equal protection and due process was intended to avoid just the problem that seems to be emerging, which is the possibility that our rights are going to be a patchwork from state to state.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly right. Even though I think we need to bear in mind that, it's not as if the court is handing states the power to control our destiny. The court emphatically said no. When it comes to gun ownership and gun rights, then we can't trust states to protect this right. Then there still is this kind of very powerful oversight that we will engage in. And so it is pretty astonishing to think that, at the one hand, the court seems to use this rhetoric of when it comes to abortion, we're simply returning the issue to the democratic process in the states. And yet that is the same democratic process that presumably the court is telling us can't be trusted to deal in a responsible fashion with guns, which is obviously an incredibly important local issue. It's not as if there's even a kind of coherence to the jurisprudence that the court is articulating here. It seems to be returning issues to the states when that is in agreement with the kind of larger political vision of the country that they entertain, and to continue to arrogate powers unto themselves when that agrees with their understanding of the constitutional design.
Well, in the closing minutes here, we've been talking about the Supreme Court, the expansion and contraction of rights that their cases point to. But there's a beginning of pushback. There's a rabbi in Florida who did what we were jokingly talking about a couple of weeks ago. He's now filed suit saying that the ban on abortion violates his religious liberties. Across the country, there are lawsuits challenging the so-called trigger laws. There are legislative measures to declare reproductive rights to be part of state constitutions. How much of this is going to work? And do suits like the rabbi's suit have legs? Is it a smart move to put the right reproductive rights before the voters in states and put it to a vote? Or are we just falling into a trap laid by these cases?
Well, I think it's very telling that Ron DeSantis, who's the presumptive big challenger to Donald Trump for the Republican nomination in 2024, has been very quiet on abortion rights. He said absolutely nothing and has dodged every question about abortion rights, because I think he recognizes that the population, for the most part, is somewhat moderate on abortion rights. Sure, in some states you're going to get substantial majorities that are totally anti-abortion. Some of the really religious southern states, it happens to overlap with the slave states very closely. But in a lot of other states, where it's not so clear cut. There is a, I mean, the American public opinion is something like 70% in favor of permitting first trimester abortions, and something like 85% in favor of permitting abortions in the cases of rape, incest, or where there's a health issue for the mother. These are big political numbers. And from the, you know, what the Supreme Court folks would say is that, you know, giving it to the voters is kind of how it should be. And if the voters go ahead and you know, ensconce these abortion rights in their statutes and in their constitutions, then so be it. That's what the federal constitution envisioned. It's not part of the federal constitution. So it'll be very interesting in some ways to see whether views have truly changed in the American population at large since Roe versus Wade crystallized the right to abortion and kind of removed it from the political debate. Certainly many other rights that the Supreme Court had crystallized have very different public reactions today than when the Supreme Court stepped in. Interracial marriage is supported by something like 85% of Americans, which is very different from where it was in the 1980s when it was, I think, something like 55% of Americans. So, you know, people's attitudes change and the argument, at least to a certain degree, in favor of the view the Supreme Court is taking on some of these controversial rights is that, you know, maybe the people can be trusted to do the right thing. Ultimately, it's their choice, is what these folks would say.
Lawrence, I want to give you a couple of minutes to just close this out. We're about out of time. You had the courage back before January 6th to go in writing and publish a book predicting predicting the insurrection of January 6th, and you were right. And I'd like to ask you the big question and perhaps the final question tonight. Where do you see this going and what should we be doing about it?
Well, maybe one thing we should think about is, and this maybe goes back to a point that Ben had made earlier when he was quoting Justice Scalia, who had observed that the biggest problem with the Constitution is the process by which it's amended. That he basically said that Article 5 of the Constitution, it's just simply too hard to amend our Constitution. Because a lot of the problems that we find that I think are at the source of our the kind of political troubles that we face today, it's not simply because of a Supreme Court that is exceptionally radical or exceptionally reactionary or a combination of both. It's, I think, the problems within the design of the Constitution itself. And, you know, part of them things like, you know, look at something like the Electoral College. We wouldn't even necessarily be concerned about 2024 if it weren't for the distorting effect that the Electoral College has on presidential elections. We would not have a Supreme Court as conservative and as out of touch with the American public today if it weren't for the Electoral College that basically made Donald Trump a electoral victor, despite the fact that he lost by a substantial majority in the popular vote. Getting rid of the Electoral College, though, is almost impossible. People have been trying to get rid of the Electoral College. The first serious effort to abolish the Electoral College came in 1816, and it has happened again and again. So I think we need to look at our constitutional design itself if we're really to solve our problems.
All right. Well, on that note, and I'm sure we'll continue this discussion in the future, you have been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW FM 91.7. Thanks to our guest tonight, and thank you. And don't forget to stand up for your legal rights. This is Dean Johnson saying good night.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.